Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to EAN Cast, Weekly Neurology. My name is Gabriela Rusin. I am co-chair of the EAN Scientific Panel on Clinical Neurophysiology. Today, we talk about non-invasive neuromodulation in neurology. What works and what is coming next? We focus on two big families of tools, magnetic pulses, RTMS, and weak electrical currents, TES. Our guest is Professor Jakub Andczak from University Hospital in Kraków, Poland. Professor Andczak works with transcranial magnetic stimulation, especially RTMS, in clinical practice and research. Welcome, Professor Andczak. It is great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Before we start, one sentence for the listener. What's the promise of neuromodulation in neurology?
It is to induce brain plasticity, optimally a long-term plasticity of the brain or the, in general, nervous system, which will improve the management of neurological disorders.
We often say neurological diseases are network disorders. What does it mean in practice, and why does it matter for neuromodulation?
We say that because neurological disorders almost never are confined to a single structure of the nervous system. There are maybe a few exceptions, such as traumatic or entrapment peripheral mononeuropathies. But in general, even in the case of localized primary lesion, such as in cerebral stroke, functional changes occur in many brain areas, not directly affected by cerebrovascular process. Areas interconnected via neuronal pathways and whole networks change their functioning in response to any, also clearly localized pathology. It determines our approach with neuromodulation as a therapeutic option, which should take into consideration such complexity. More and more frequently, it means stimulation in multiple sites, also outside the primary lesion.
What do we mean by non-invasive brain stimulation, and how is it different from deep brain stimulation and other techniques of the invasive neurostimulation?
The non-invasive brain stimulation is a group of techniques of the non-invasive neurostimulation, a subgroup of techniques of the non-invasive neurostimulation, as we can stimulate also peripheral nervous system and the spinal cord. The term neurostimulation in medicine means to act on nervous system with physical forces and not with chemical ones, right? Like, for example, in the case of pharmacotherapy. The term non-invasive brain stimulation means that we stimulate the brain with the stimulating force being localized outside the body of the stimulated person. An ambiguity exists regarding the electroconvulsive therapy, which is the oldest technique of brain stimulation. Pure anatomically, the technique is of course non-invasive. It is, however, often not regarded as such, and the reason is the need of general anesthesia, of anesthesiologic neuromuscular relaxation, and of invasive ventilation, which are together a deep intervention. Maybe it is also worth to mention that in the broader sense, the neurostimulation does not need to be always therapeutic. A frequently performed electrical stimulation of peripheral nerves to assess the nerve conduction is an example of a diagnostic stimulation. Also, the transcranial magnetic stimulation, one of the most widely used techniques of non-invasive brain stimulation, was initially designed not to induce plasticity for therapeutic purposes, but to assess brain excitability and the conduction in central motor pathways. It is also nowadays increasingly used to map the brain eloquent areas before neurosurgical operation.
For someone new to the topic, how would you explain the difference between RTMS, so magnetic pulses, and TES, electrical currents?
Beginning with what they have in common, they both are transcranial magnetic stimulation and transcranial electrical stimulation. They both are the most widely used techniques of non-invasive brain stimulation. considering the electroconvulsive therapy as invasive. The key difference is that RTMS, repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, uses the pulses of magnetic field, and transcranial TES, transcranial electrical stimulation, uses the electric current. It is a weak current, considerably weaker than in the case of electroconvulsive therapy, so there is no need for anesthesia, and it is possible to use this technique at home. The current is also not strong enough to depolarize the brain cells, in other words, to trigger neuronal firing. TES is rather able to modify the transmembrane potential, which will facilitate the firing and increase responsiveness, as well as to modify intrinsic brain oscillations. In contrast, transcranial magnetic stimulation depolarizes local neuronal population. Both electric current and magnetic pulses will induce brain plasticity if done consequently and repetitively enough. Depending on the settings of stimulation, this plasticity, as complex and multidirectional it may be, will go generally towards long-term potentiation with increased local neuronal activity, blood flow, and synaptic plasticity, or towards long-term depression with opposite changes. Both of them, potentiation and depression, are used to achieve clinical improvement, depending on particular disease, with some disease benefiting from both. Of note, both techniques have their particular forms and submodalities. Yet while the term transcranial magnetic stimulation is relatively constantly used, regardless of which submodality is meant, the term transcranial electrical stimulation is used less frequently. More often you will read in the literature the specific name of its particular submodality, and you will also hear it when you come to neurophysiological laboratory. These submodalities are transcranial direct current stimulation, transcranial alternating current stimulation, and transcranial random noise stimulation.
Which approach usually require trained staff and a specialized center? And which ones can be simpler or potentially home-based under supervision?
Both approaches, together with all other techniques of neurostimulation, require trained staff, a physician to qualify the patient, and a technician to perform the procedure. It is wise to send your patient to a center specialized in neurostimulation. However, as the techniques become more common, they are also available in small psychiatric and neurologic ambulatories. Transcranial magnetic stimulation must not be at home, mainly because of the risk of a seizure, whereas electrical stimulation can be home-based. It must be initiated in a center, in a medical facility, but thereafter it can be used at home safely.
And if I walked into a stimulation session, could I tell right away which method is being used? What would I notice? What should I look into?
At the beginning is similar for both methods. You will sit in a comfortable reclining chair. Then the personnel from electric stimulation would wipe your head and then stick two big electrodes. Whereas in transcranial magnetic stimulation lab, they would place the stimulating coil over your skull. A stimulating coil is a disc or two combined discs which make up a figure of eight, or sometimes it can have also L shape. In TES lab, you will feel the electric current passing between electrodes, which may be sometimes a bit unpleasant. In TMS laboratory, the staff will begin with moving the coil over your skull and eliciting single pulses of magnetic field. They will also be watching if there are no twitching of fingers or hand contralateral to hemisphere they are stimulating. In this way, they are looking for the primary motor cortex. Once they find it, they start to stimulate at this site, determining what is the weakest magnetic field still capable to excite the motor pathways to the musculature of your hand and fingers. In other words, they are estimating the motor threshold. In some laboratories, they place electrodes which record the electric potential from twitching muscles instead of just watching the hand. Next, they measure your head to determine the exact site of therapeutic stimulation. Sometimes they use also magnetic resonance imaging of your head and the neural navigation system instead of measuring. On the basis of estimated motor threshold, they calculate the strength of therapeutic magnetic field. Once therapeutic stimulation starts, you feel a train of stimuli elicited with constant frequency or in a more complex pattern. Sometimes, especially when your prefrontal areas are stimulated, TMS may be painful.
And when we say target, what do we usually mean? What does it actually mean? Is it a single brain area or the whole brain network?
I will always act directly on a certain brain area with spatial resolution of 3 to 5 square centimeters for TMS and much lower resolution for TES. Both methods don't reach deep. Only the cortex can be effectively stimulated. Maybe we could mention here the newer modalities of brain stimulation, which still are rather in experimental settings, but which allow stimulation of subcortical structures. One is the transcranial focus ultrasound, which uses low-intensity ultrasound waves, which focus on a certain area with great spatial resolution. Another is the transcranial temporal interference stimulation, which uses two or more electric fields elicited with high frequency. Regardless of the technique used, regardless of its spatial resolution, we should always be aware that we influence the whole networks, including distant areas, via transsynaptic connections.
Can you briefly explain what the DLPFC is and why it's such a common target?
Indeed, it appears quite commonly in the literature. It stands for dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It is a core hub of the central executive network and is also involved in attention, executive function, and working memory. In psychiatry, it is the most frequently stimulated area, especially the left one on the left side, with very good results in treatment of the drug-resistant depression and other psychiatric disorders. Of neurological indications, it is a common target in treatment of dementia and other processes with impairment of cognitive function. It is also one of the main targets of treatment of migraine. It is also recently one of the main targets in childhood neurology, pediatric neurology, during treatment trials to treat cerebral palsy.
In a recent paper in Nature Reviews Neurology, there is a summary of the advances in the field of neuromodulation neurology. And the results described there often look inconsistent. Why do you think that is?
Stimulation is rather constant. I mean, stimulation site, stimulation strength, and the frequency and pattern of the pulses vary across studies, but only to some extent. Of main neuropsychiatric diseases which are a subject of stimulation, one can find several studies with the same stimulation parameters, and the results will indeed vary. The reason is probably the inter-individual heterogeneity, most important heterogeneity in the underlying pathology of given disease. An example is the cortical versus subcortical stroke, with the latter responding better to the stimulation. Another example may be patients with cognitive impairment with or without marked cortical atrophy. Atrophy increases the distance between stimulating electrode or coil and the cortex, which will negatively impact the efficacy. But there is probably much more yet undiscovered pathophysiologic heterogeneity within particular diseases which determines the responsiveness. Recently, studies started to collect imaging, neurophysiological, for example, EEG, and laboratory data, for example, BDNF level, at baseline and also across the intervention and during the follow-up. This may help in the future to select the patients responsive to stimulation and to better understand the mechanism of action of particular neurostimulation modalities, which may in turn improve the consistency. One should also not forget that there is also an intra-individual variability. It is known, for example, that the time of the day and the caffeine use affect the response to TMS.
So do you think that the source of this variability of the results might be because of the patient selection or targeting or dose or the outcome measures?
Yes, indeed, yes. But I hope, and I hope a systematic collection of the data I mentioned will allow in the future reliable selection of potential responders, as well as a selection of suitable stimulating protocols tailored for a particular patient. Outcome measures should also be more consistent across studies. But on the other hand, use of multiple tools give more complete view of efficacy of neurostimulation.
So let's go condition by condition. Starting with Alzheimer's disease, what are the main targets and what's the rationale?
In Alzheimer's disease, we stimulate predominantly the prefrontal areas with protocols intended to induce the long-term potentiation. In TDCS, it will be the anodal stimulation, whereas in RTMS, it will be the high frequencies from 5 Hz upwards. And the more complex protocol called the intermittent theta burst stimulation. Precisely, the target is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which we mentioned already. It might be bilateral or on the left side. Some experts are concerned about inducing the long-term potentiation in the right prefrontal area, as it may contribute to the development of depression. The reason for prefrontal cortex is the fact we already mentioned that this area is the key hub of executive network and the key area for our higher cognitive functions. This approach is, however, evolving, as our view of the neurodegenerative diseases is more and more network-oriented, so is the neuromodulation strategy. Modern studies involve frequently a multi-site stimulation. An example is the NeuroAD protocol, where besides the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, also the precuneus and the parietal cortex are stimulated. In cerebral stroke and in traumatic brain injury, we currently focus mainly on the lesion side. In cerebral stroke, it will be predominantly the motor cortex. We stimulate the lesion side with mentioned protocols intending to induce the long-term potentiation. Interestingly, common approach is also to stimulate the contralesional motor cortex to induce the long-term depression. It means with low frequencies such as 1 Hz or with the continuous theta burst stimulation or with the cathodal stimulation in case of TDCS. Such stimulation of the contralesional hemisphere is performed to harness its inhibiting influence on the recovery of the lesion's hemisphere. Another interesting approach is the stimulation to induce analgesic effect in neuropathic pain. The protocol most commonly used is magnetic stimulation over the primary motor cortex with high frequency or anodal electric stimulation of the primary motor cortex. The putative mechanism of action in case of the magnetic stimulation is the antidromic excitation of thalamocortical pathways and thus to modulate the function of thalamus, a key structure in pain processing. Notwithstanding this, protocols in neurological disorders are still being optimized. An example is recently raised role of cerebral stimulation for cognitive impairment in neurodegenerative diseases.
How about accelerated protocols? What do they mean and do they change the clinical impact?
They changed dramatically the clinical impact in psychiatry, where stimulation with up to 10 sessions a day instead of just one traditionally, reduced the total time to achieve remission in drug-resistant depression and apparently increased efficacy. In the area of neurologic diseases, results are conflicting. In our lab, we tried accelerated RTMS to bring relief in neuropathic pain with inconsistent effect.
After acquired brain injury, can we non-invasively improve cognition, for example, after TBI? What's realistic today?
I think in general, we don't know it yet. the results of studies and meta-analyses are conflicting. In contrast to neurodegenerative diseases, cognitive deficits after brain injury are often associated with delineated brain lesion, often in subcortical areas, for example, within the limbic system, if we only could reach with our stimulation deeper. It will be probably possible with newer emerging neurostimulation modalities we mentioned. Yet we have to wait.
I would like to ask for Parkinson's disease because pharmacotherapy and deep brain stimulation seem to be well-established option for PD. Does non-invasive stimulation fit in Parkinson's disease? And if yes, where?
There might be some efficacy and not only regarding the motor symptoms. The results are, however, conflicting so far. Neurostimulation generally does not modify neurodegenerative process, and the TDCS and RTMS do not reach to the basal ganglia, so the effects are rather transient and not huge. Indication which may have a chance to become an established option is the treatment of Parkinson-related depression, which otherwise is difficult to treat with drugs. Regarding motor, cognitive, and other symptoms, maybe we can expect better efficacy from the newer stimulation methods, which are able to reach subcortical structures.
Let's move to stroke rehabilitation. Many people think stimulate motor cortex and recovery improves. How does it work? Is it really that simple?
It is not only the motor cortex. We can stimulate, for example, the right inferior frontal gyrus to rehabilitate the post-stroke aphasia. In contrast to neurodegenerative diseases, the stroke is a non-progressive process, so the functions which are gained with the neurostimulation may not be lost. Overall results from meta-analysis suggest patients benefit from neurostimulation, albeit with high variability between subjects. In my opinion, neurostimulation should be tried in every stroke survivor suffering from substantial motor, cognitive or language deficit. Although it's not sure if our patient will benefit, there is a significant hope he will. Therefore, we should try.
Across these conditions we discussed, how important is pairing stimulation with therapy or training?
It is always advisable to stimulate along with routine rehabilitation, which will help to maintain the gained function. The good example is a neuroadder device, which is a set manufactured to perform TMS and cognitive training at once in patients with Alzheimer's disease and all other dementias. So it's always advisable to combine rehabilitation and neuromodulation.
TMS and TES mainly affect the cortex. We already established that. Are we getting closer to modulating deeper targets non-invasively? Two ideas that come up are temporal interference stimulation and low-intensity focused ultrasound. In one sentence each, what's the basic idea?
The transcranial focused ultrasound uses a low-intensity ultrasound waves, which converge in the chosen brain structure. The intensity of waves is strong enough to exert mechanical pressure on cell membranes and on their ion channels, which in turn depolarizes the neurons in a safe and reversible manner. This method is characterized by an excellent spatial resolution. The second one is the transcranial temporal interference stimulation, which uses two or sometimes more high frequency over 1000 Hz electric fields, which differ slightly regarding their frequency. One of them can be, for example, 1000 Hz and the other 1005 Hz. The difference will be then 5 Hz. As the fields interfere within a given brain area, the difference produces a low frequency field of 5 Hz, which is safe and suitable to influence the neural excitability.
When you think about next 5-10 years, is the future mainly about personalization, better targeting, better timing and dosing?
We hope personalization in terms of determining the imaging, neurophysiological and laboratory data will enhance the efficacy. better targeting with multifocal stimulation, modifying systematically significant hubs of dysfunctional networks, may further contribute to the outcomes. Finally, we should not forget the closed-loop paradigms, with stimulation continuously being adjusted to the monitored biological signals, for example, electroencephalography.
Let's be practical. Outside scientific setting, what feels ready for careful clinical application and what should stay research only for now?
Transcranial magnetic stimulation and transcranial electrical stimulation are safely used in clinical settings across the world. Transcranial focused ultrasound, transcranial temporal interference stimulation, and other more esoteric techniques still await recommendations of expert societies regarding safety indications and parameters of stimulation, as well as guidelines of training and certifications.
Final message to the listener. What's the one thing you want people to remember?
Please remember there is such a therapeutic option as neuromodulation with neurological indications we talked about. These are the main post-stroke deficits, neuropathic pain, and also neurodegenerative dementia, sometimes also migraine and drug-resistant migraine, and several others. Maybe one condition emerging and very important is are the neurological diseases in pediatric population, especially cerebral palsy. Please do not forget also about depression, especially drug-resistant one, as it coexists often with severe neurologic diseases.
Thank you, Professor Anczak, for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to EAN Cast Weekly Neurology.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.